I want to start by saying thank you to the organizers of this conference. It's really been wonderful, and I'm thrilled to be here. I want to talk about race and copyright today. So the name of my presentation is Clear White Lines, Historicizing the Development of Anti-Black Racial Scripts and Copyright. So really what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about a book project that I'm actually finishing right now, and use three examples to really hone in on what we've been talking about today. So the book that I'm working on is called The Color of Creatorship, Intellectual Property, Citizenship, and the Racialization of Knowledge. And though this conference is called 100 Years of Copyright, like a number of speakers before me, I'm going to talk about much more than 100 years to set the stage here. The central argument that the book makes is that racial inequality is actually a continuing and persistent problem in the context of intellectual property law, and particularly copyright, not simply because of legal happenstance or economic motive or racial accident, but because copyright, patent, and trademark law are fundamentally prefigured in ways that are raced through the ideas of citizenship in particular. And I'm going to focus on the American context today, but I imagine that there are some parallels as well. So I coined the term intellectual property citizenship to describe what Michel Foucault would call a grid of intelligibility that makes it possible to see the racial principles around which familiar and repeated doctrinal standards in copyright, patent, and trademark law are structured. Applied to the theme of the panel, I would argue that we can't understand either plagiarism or appropriation without focusing on race itself, particularly whiteness and the way that whiteness works as property, to echo Cheryl Harris, and its historical development over time. To that end, I've written about the need to bring together critical race theory and intellectual property law in an interdisciplinary framework called critical race IP. And today I want to talk about how the explicit or formal racial limitations on copyright law evolved into colorblind ones through the doctrinal language of true imagination and citizenship. Because Americanness is structured through a racial episteme, or a kind of common sense raced way of knowing that a priori constrains the possibilities for treating people of color as full persons, let alone creators, citizenship actually works as a vehicle for importing race into copyright law. And the three examples that I'm going to talk about today actually emphasize anti-blackness, but the book talks about different racial identities as well. So my method involves around tracing what Natalia Molina calls racial scripts, or historically grounded and flexible racial logics that are repeated in order to denigrate people of color. And racial scripts can appear to be colorblind when they invoke the ideals of citizenship, i.e. hard work, merit, ruggedness, and so on. And that becomes a covert means of talking about race. So let me start with the first example. I moved through three eras of copyright, the first being that of the citizen creator. So in 1790, Phyllis Wheatley, the first published black poet in the United States, was put on trial. And she was put on trial by the self-proclaimed most respectable characters in Boston in order to determine whether she had the requisite creativity to have created the poems that she claimed to have written. At this time, only citizens were allowed to register copyrights, and Wheatley was a slave. And while Wheatley was allowed to ultimately publish her poems, Thomas Jefferson, who had never met her before, wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia years later, "Misery is often the parent of the most affecting touches in poetry. Among the blacks is misery enough, God knows, but not poetry. Love is the peculiar ostrum of the poet. Their love is ardent, but it kindles the senses only, not the imagination. Religion, indeed, has produced a Phyllis Wheatley, but it could not produce a poet. The compositions published under her names are below the dignity of criticism." This language of true imagination that Jefferson uses is obviously a subjective one, and it's one which evolves into a racial script of anti-blackness in the 1800s and 1900s. In cases that I'm not going to talk about today, but cases such as those involving Aunt Jemima, race records in the context of jazz, and even Charlie Chaplin imitators. while I don't talk about those cases here, they all use that explicit racial language in the context of the notion of imagination and imitation to judge people of color as involving or as lacking the kind of creativity that's required for copyright. And that discussion is always couched in terms of the language of Americanness, hard work, innovativeness, ingenuity, and so on. And this is something that will is a thread that we can draw through from the talks from yesterday. So the next era I want to talk about, jumping forward about 200 years, is that of race, liberalism, and creatorship. So we've heard about hip-hop and rap, but I want to approach them from a slightly different angle to understand how copyright law can seem racially liberal, yet be racially problematic at the same time. So in the 1980s, following in the footsteps of former Motion Picture Association of America President Jack Valenti, the Parents Music Resource Center declared a list of songs the Filthy 15. And while there are originally only two artists of color on that list, Prince and the Mary Jane Girls, the Recording Industry Association of America took up Valenti's self-policing system in the form of warning labels on music. And in 1987, Ice-T's Rhyme Pays was the first rap album with such a sticker. In 1990, NWA was arrested in Detroit for an incident that happened after they played Fuck the Police the same year. Soon after that, the Two Live Crew was tried on obscenity charges. Two Live Crew's defense attorney, who ultimately won the case, said, "This is not violin music, this is not piano music, but this is serious art, even though it may be different." But like Valenti did in the VCR wars, the RIAA and the courts seem to be waging a racial war to protect whiteness, again, as intellectual property this time. So in that context, if we reread the dispute between Bismarcky and Gilbert O'Sullivan, which you'll recall starts with "Thou shalt not steal," the court's determination that Bismarcky was a malicious criminal and Gilbert O'Sullivan was a, quote, credible witness, that demonstrates a couple of things. One is a consistent refusal on the part of the courts to recognize black creatorship as, quote, true imagination, now in the context of the new legal standard of originality. And two, that there is an invocation, a spillover, of fear of crime rhetorics from the time that are related to urbanization. I saw Stuart Hall's Policing the Crisis in the gift shop. This is the same argument that he makes in the context of the UK. So both of these rhetorical moves are moves to protect whiteness, particularly by positing that black artists are the enemy of allegedly race-neutral standards of meritocracy, of hard work, and of innovation. This is how black art and black male bodies in particular become a canvas on which national anxieties about morality, sexuality, crime, and the American dream get played out. And while we might be tempted to read the victories of Two Live Crew and Alice Randall in the literary context as disproving this theory, those are actually exceptions that prove the rule. So in those moments where the courts do protect black artists, it's in the context of a very narrow case-by-case fair use exception that creates what I call parodic exceptionalism. Essentially, black artists have to meet a much higher standard of creativity than white artists do in order to protect their work. So similarly, if we think about the dispute between George Clinton and NWA, that's an interesting one, which sets the stage for my last example, because Clinton did not actually want that lawsuit to happen, but he didn't really have that control over that question. So the same company, Bridgeport Music, as you probably know, sued on behalf of Marvin Gaye's estate in the context of the song Blurred Lines, which is the last example. So the last example I want to turn to is that of post-racial creatorship. Blurred Lines is an interesting case because it gets framed as one in which Thick is stealing from Gay, except that there are black artists on both sides. And various cultural issues here really complicate the case. So I want to make the argument that it's actually a failure of Thick's white masculinity here. The fact that he is so embroiled in a variety of gender disputes in a way that we might characterize using Richard Dyer's term, the bad white, that he becomes a spectacle that overshadows his potential as a romantic author. In short, Thicke can't live up to that ideal because of his gender politics. On the other hand, Gay's Gotta Give It Up is also notable as what Gerald Early terms a nostalgic memoir of Motown, a place and sound in which older black and white generations achieved the mythic American dream and appeared to triumph over racism. So there's this kind of sentimentality that's attached to Marvin Gaye's work, who, and we should note that Marvin Gaye doesn't necessarily have better gender politics than Thicke does, but there's a kind of sentimentality attached to both the civil rights movement and the place and time that he is playing coming out of Motown that allows him to seem to be a more sympathetic individual in that case. I would also add that Pharrell stands for a genre of authorship that for many Americans still calls upon those fears of crime that are invoked in the earlier cases involving hip hop and rap. So in the end, Marvin Gaye, even though he's associated with a time of national tumult, offered a classic musical style that we could romanticize, that we could think about in this particular context of creative genius. So in this context, romantic creatorship actually prefigures the economic. So oftentimes we want to talk about copyright in terms of the economics of it, but we have to also think about the way the economics are fundamentally prefigured with our conceptions of what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be an American, and what that means in international context as well. So James Boyle and Keith Aoki lay the groundwork for that argument in the context of their comic book, which, if you haven't seen it, is available online. It's really fantastic. Theft, A History of Music. So thinking about blurred lines is not as easy of a thing as sometimes it is portrayed to be in the media. It's actually a really complex negotiation that happens between a number of actors. So black and white publics from the soul and post-soul generations, feminists, often white feminists and anti-racists, white-owned production companies like Bridgeport Music who stand to gain a considerable amount of money from cases coming out the way that they do. And a number of other ideological investments that the public might have. So the case illustrates how the legal system consistently disenfranchises black creators through sentimental divide and conquer politics, through invocations of economic rationality that seem to be race neutral, and also through colorblindness. This case I want to posit is actually a lose-lose situation that involves choosing between Gaye's mass-produced Motown sound, and we could talk about the critiques of Motown and what's good about it and so on, and the questionable feminist politics of Thicke and Pharrell's mass-produced pop sound. And that is ultimately both nostalgic, the outcome of the case is both nostalgic and reparative in troubling ways and ways that have a lot of potential. That lose-lose situation that seemingly coincidentally reappears in intellectual property cases involving people of color, I want to argue, is a feature, not a flaw, of the intellectual property system. It's not coincidental that the evolving legal standards seem to always protect whiteness as intellectual property. One of the structural reasons, and I want to end on this note, that I posit for this is actually related to the cartel notion that was mentioned before. So I use this idea of mafia capitalism to think about the ways that a small set of actors essentially produces structures and legal doctrines to protect copyright. So if we think about the who and why of copyright law and where it comes from, what we see is that individual copyright speeches and organizations like the RIAA and MPAA are invested in a certain kind of racial politics as well as a certain kind of economic politics. Thank you.